dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of the most important battlefronts in that war, of course, is the Middle East, and one of our most important allies in that battle space, and, well, a lot of others for that matter, is, of course, the state of Israel. Few people know Israel better, have thought more thoughtfully and seriously about the U.S.-Israeli relationship and, more generally, the state of our world than our first guest. She is the great Carolyn Glick. She is the author of Shackled Warrior, Israel and the Global Jihad, and The Israeli Solution, a one-state plan for peace in the Middle East. I'm very pleased to say she is a senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy, and she is helping direct our Israel Security Project, and we couldn't be more pleased to have her with us. Carolyn, thank you so much for taking a few minutes. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's great to be back on your program, Frank.
Thank you. Let me ask you first and foremost, Carolyn, to help decipher the results of this election that took place earlier this week in Israel. There's a lot of reporting to the effect that Bibi Netanyahu will not be able to put together a governing coalition, and the so-called blue and white party led by the former chief of staff of the Israel Defense Forces, General Gantz, will put that coalition together. Is that so? And if not, what do you think is likely to happen?
No, thanks for asking that question. There's been a lot of misinterpretation of the Israeli election results. Partially, it's a result of wishful thinking by media that overwhelmingly opposes the Israeli right, just as they oppose the American right, the British right. But it's also because Americans have a hard time understanding coalition politics in Israel's parliamentary democracy, because it's so different from the constitutional system in the United States and the two-party system. So Israel is a parliamentary democracy. The government is formed by a coalition of parties. We have a multi-party democracy that have to have a majority in our parliament, which is called the Knesset. The Knesset has 120 members. So you need 61 members in a coalition in order to govern. The Likud party, the governing Likud party that Netanyahu leads, and its natural coalition allies, the further right parties and the more religious social conservative parties, have a minority of 55 seats. And so they can't form a government on their own. But on the other hand, the blue and white party led by Gantz, they got two more seats than Likud did. They got 33 seats to Likud's 31. But their natural allies on the left, and they together only have 44, so they don't have a coalition either. So they can't form a coalition, because if they add the Arab parties to the 44 seats, they still don't have a governing majority, only have 57 seats, and they can't really add the Arabs, because the three Arab parties in the Knesset are all anti-Israel. None of them recognize Israel's right to exist, and they support terrorism, they support Hamas. And so they're not viable partners in any governing coalition in Israel. And then we have the wild card party, which has 8 seats. It's run by a former defense minister, Avigdor Lieberman, and he refuses to join a coalition with Netanyahu. But on the other hand, he won't join a coalition with the Arabs, which means that the Gantz and blue and white have no path to a coalition. He didn't win. His party got more Knesset seats, but he can't form a government, which means that he can't be the prime minister.
Yeah. So, Carolyn, if the Likud party under Benjamin Netanyahu can't form a coalition either, does that mean that Israel will go back to the third round of elections in the space of 6 months or so? Or is there some other way ahead as you see it?
That is a possibility. There is another possibility. There are two other possibilities. What Netanyahu did immediately after the election is that he took all the splinter parties and he unified them with Likud. And they signed an agreement that they would all negotiate as a block of 55 and that they wouldn't enter any government as separate parties. It would only enter as a block. The minute that he did that, he essentially ensured that all things being equal, he'll form the next government, because eventually, over the next 6 weeks, when a government is supposed to be formed, the greater likelihood is that either blue and white will splinter. Blue and white itself is a consortium of three separate parties. So it's possible that one of them will break off. And if they begin to splinter, then the most likely scenario under that condition is that the left-wing Labor Party, which is now just a small party, the party that used to be the governing party of Israel for Israel's first 31 years, now only has 6 seats, but that's sufficient to form a majority coalition with the right-wing bloc. So I think at the end of the day, it's possible that they're just going to form a government with Likud. Likud will give them whatever ministerial positions they demand, and they will form a stable governing coalition under Netanyahu. I think that's most likely. People say, well, Netanyahu is going to be indicted in a month or so, and therefore he's going to have to step down. But that's not true either. That's sort of a mischaracterization. It's true that he's being subjected to criminal probes much along the lines of the Russia collusion probe that Trump has been subjected to for the past 2 years. But the wheels of injustice also move very slowly in Israel. So I think that this is going to drag on much longer than the commentators on the left would like. So I think that at the end of the day, will probably either go to new elections, or Netanyahu will form a government either with some splinter of blue and white or with the Labor Party.
Yeah. Carolyn, I just want to draw you out on one thing. You know, we're endlessly told by those who are caviling against Israel and this country in particular, the so-called boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, BDS, that Israel is an apartheid state. And yet you've just described three different Arab parties that are actually in the Knesset of Israel that are rabidly opposed to the state of Israel, the existence of the state of Israel. And yet this is hardly an example of a population that is being treated to apartheid, is it, if their representatives are in parliament?
If this is apartheid, and it's an insult to the blacks of South Africa, that, you know, if you want to call this apartheid, then what do you call what they went through? Because what they went through is something completely different. No, you know, the Washington Post wrote a very vicious editorial, I think, yesterday, which was just stunning in its mischaracterization of Israel and the political realities. They were essentially claiming that Netanyahu is a racist for not wanting the Arabs to join a coalition government with Gantz and blue and white, and for warning Israelis that, you know, the Arabs are going to be voting in very high numbers and trying to get his people out to vote. But that's a complete mischaracterization of the situation here vis-a-vis the Arabs of Israel, because what actually is the case is that the Arabs of Israel, you know, it's interesting because the polling data suggests that the sentiments of the Arab citizenry are quite different from the sentiments of their elected leaders, which has a lot to do with this political patronage and funding from outside forces like the EU and Qatar and left-wing groups in the United States.
Carolyn, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Carolyn Glick is with us. I'm very pleased to say she is a senior fellow for the Center for Security Policy. She writes for Breitbart. She is also the author of two terrific books, Shackled Warrior and The Israeli Solution, which talks about a peace plan for the Middle East. And Carolyn, it seems as though at the moment, the Middle East is about as far removed from peace as it has been in some time. I wanted to ask you, especially in light of what has been happening lately, which seemed to be quite promising in terms of reordering the prospects for war or perhaps a more stable Middle East, namely the rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. that this attack by the Iranians, either directly or through proxies, it's still being assessed, but nonetheless, it's quite clear it came from the Iranians, against Saudi Arabia's oil infrastructure, which had devastating effects on its productive throughput, is a very, very ominous new ratcheting up by the Iranians of the conflict between that country and some of its foes, notably Saudi Arabia, of course, but perhaps this new sort of alliance, if you will, or at least modus vivendi with Israel as well. Talk us through how you see this attack, what prompted it, and what's likely to come from it.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. The attack last Saturday on the Abqaiq oil processing facility in Saudi Arabia and the large oil fields in Saudi Arabia essentially, or at least temporarily, took out 5% of the world oil supply from production, which is an act of war, not only against Saudi Arabia, but, you know, for many years, the NATO plans was also considered to be an act of war against the United States and NATO, because it harms the global economy. Now, the harm, of course, to the global economy was mitigated by U.S. oil production, the shale revolution, and energy in the United States. But be that as it may, this was an absolute act of war against Saudi Arabia in an attempt to cause a massive damage to the global economy by the Iranians. And so the question is, you know, what do you do in this situation? And unfortunately, from the American perspective, President Trump is hard pressed to deal with this because he's facing re-election next year, and he has a large percentage of his base are isolationists who are tired of the Middle East and its wars, and they don't want to get involved. And it's very difficult to make the case for a retaliatory strike against Iran's strategic installations and its nuclear installations in order to ensure that this kind of aggression doesn't escalate so further, which the Iranians are threatening daily that it will. So, you know, the question is what can be done. And I think that we found the answer in the way that operations have been taking place against Iran for the past year since President Trump left the Iran nuclear deal that Obama had concluded. And of course, that deal gave Iran a glide path to a nuclear arsenal by 2025 and gave them sanctions relief to the tune of $150 billion. So when Trump walked away from that deal, he reinstituted the economic sanctions on Iran that Obama had rescinded or suspended with the implementation of the nuclear deal in 2015. And this has caused a lot of economic harm to the Iranian economy, financial harm, economic harm, harm in their trade and their exports, which is all to the good. But because of President Trump's reticence about getting embroiled in Middle Eastern wars, the main kinetic aspect of the American maximum pressure campaign has been carried out largely by Israel, with American backing, and the reported Israeli strikes against Iranian installations and terror targets in Iraq and in Syria and to a lesser degree in Lebanon. And the Saudis and the UAE have been fighting the Iranian proxy army, the Houthis, in Yemen in order to block Iran from gaining control of the Bab el-Mandeb oil choke point, waterway that serves as an oil choke point as well, from the Red Sea. So you have a lot of American allies who are doing most of the heavy lifting here. And I think that the assessment that I've made of the situation, particularly given Trump's political constraints going into 2020, is that, you know, we'll likely see, you know, what's likely being formed now is a coalition of Israelis on the one hand and the Saudis and the UAE on the other to retaliate with American backing, infrastructural backing in the Persian Gulf, but not with America doing most of the heavy lifting. President Trump said this week that he wanted the Saudis to pay financially for whatever retaliatory strike takes place, that the United States isn't going to get involved to the tune of $1 trillion the way that it did in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and that he wants America's allies to really be doing the heavy lifting financially and militarily. And the Americans, of course, will continue to maintain and ratchet up their economic war against Iran. He announced that the sanctions against Iran are going to be stiffened as a result of this attack. So we'll have to see. Obviously, Israel's political paralysis is making it difficult for it to take major initiatives militarily. And the Saudis, with all of their wonderful, expensive American hardware and military platforms that they've built, that they've purchased over the years, they still don't seem to be fully competent to use them. But I think that these, no matter what, if we compare ourselves to where we were vis-a-vis Iran under Obama, where the United States was actually helping Iran against its allies in a lot of different ways, that still this isn't optimal. This may be the best opportunity that we have to really take advantage of Iran's extraordinary aggression in order to take out their nuclear installations and some of their regime targets, particularly Revolutionary Guard bases inside of Iran.
Yeah, Carolyn, just, I guess, a reality check. Is there any solution, as you see it, to the Iranian threat and its continued metastasizing, even under the circumstances of a maximum pressure campaign like President Trump has been running, short of the end of this regime in Tehran? And it's not to say that's a prescription for us taking responsibility for it. I'm just saying, can we do otherwise?
Look, you don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. I don't know whether regime change is on the table. I think it's important to take out regime-sensitive targets in order to undermine it, provide an opportunity to the Iranian people to take their freedom back from the people who have been persecuting them for the past 40 years. But I don't know that. I mean, I'm certain that there's no appetite in the United States to overthrow the Iranian regime. And Israel is ill-equipped to do that. That's really up to the Iranian people at this point. But I think that you can help them along by destabilizing the regime, by removing their nuclear deterrent to, the, you know, at least in a significant way, undermining it, cutting it down to size. I think those are things that can be done. So I think that you have to take advantage of the opportunities that you have to take maximum damage to your enemies, set them back as much as you can.
Yeah, I agree with that. Let me just turn to the other front in which Israel is now confronting the Iranian threat, and that is in Syria, as well as Lebanon, of course, which continues to metastasize under the control of Hezbollah with Iranian backing. Just give us a sense of the situation there as you see it at the moment and how that may add further urgency to the kinds of changes that we're talking about back in Tehran.
Well, as you know, I mean, Hezbollah has built up quite an arsenal of missiles, unfortunately, over the past 20 years since Israel withdrew from Lebanon in 2000. The Iranians are trying to build an indigenous capability to transform, you know, what they call dumb bombs that are just set it off into a trajectory to smart bombs that are precision-guided, GPS-guided. Projectiles against Israel, which would be a game changer from Israel's perspective. We're such a small country. There aren't that many installations to hit, to cripple the military, the Air Force, et cetera. So I think, you know, this is the kind of threat that Israel can't countenance, and they've been trying to build it. So Israel's been doing a lot of bombing in Syria and reportedly in Lebanon as well to try to prevent them from developing that kind of capability inside of Lebanon. And in the meantime, you know, I think the most important thing from the American perspective is to end all U.S. assistance to the Lebanese government. You know, for years and years and years, particularly the Pentagon has been pushing this idea that the Lebanese government is some sort of an independent bulwark against Hezbollah in Lebanon. And it's never been true.
And particularly the army of Lebanon, right?
Exactly. And all of Lebanon. I mean, the Lebanese government is controlled by Hezbollah. Quite simply. And so pretending that they're an independent entity is just lying. And I mean, it's just denying reality. And it's very dangerous.
And specifically, Carolyn, to the extent that we are actually arming the Lebanese army, is that effectively simply enhancing the military capacity of Hezbollah?
The United States has given over $500 million in military assistance to the Lebanese army over the past decade. And all of this redounds to Hezbollah's benefit. The United States is essentially arming Hezbollah's support forces with things like aircraft and tanks and rockets and, you know, night vision capabilities, communications capabilities, which they can commit espionage against Israeli troops and collect tactical intelligence against Israel in times of war. But yeah, this is all very, very terrible policy and one that really has to be ended. And I dare say there's no reason for the United States to be propping up the Lebanese economy either. If they want to be an Iranian satrapy, then let the Iranians support them. And if they can't, then let them go free. But that's really what we're seeing. The United States wants to conduct economic warfare against Iran and its proxies, and probably the best place to start is Lebanon.
Carolyn Glick, thank you very much for your time today, as always, and your extraordinary insights. We appreciate your collaboration with us once again at the Center for Security Policy, and appreciate so much your writings at Breitbart and elsewhere. Keep it up, my dear. Come back to us soon.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say, joined by John Guandolo. John is a friend and comrade in arms of many years, a former, well, graduate of the Naval Academy who went into the United States Marine Corps, joined its highly acclaimed Force Recon units, and served in combat in Desert Storm. He then went on to become first a member and then a commanding officer of the FBI's SWAT team in Washington, D.C., and then moved into the Bureau's special agent's rank and served in that capacity in, among other things, the counterterrorism business. He is a man who knows his way around both the kinetic and the non-kinetic aspects of the enemy we face in the form of what I think of as Sharia supremacists. He is particularly thoughtful on the problem we're confronting in this context of an enemy within. That is the subject, among other things, of his newest book, Islam's Deception, The Truth About Sharia. John, it is so good to have you with us. Congratulations on the new book. I'm very pleased to have a bit of time to visit with you about it and some of your other work at Understanding the Threat, a tremendously important organization that he's founded and uses to try to educate the rest of us about the true character of this threat we're facing from Sharia and its adherents. John, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks very much, Frank. Great to be back.
So to give us just the distilled essence, if you can, of the truth about Sharia, how would you characterize it?
I would characterize it as a simple book that helps put everything into context that we're experiencing with the Muslim community. I think that is, whether it's at the local community, like today's news about two individuals and American Airlines, you know, the crew not being comfortable with them flying on the plane, all the way to the war, the situation between Iran, Saudi Arabia, and how the United States government is addressing it. When you understand Sharia, it puts these things into context. And I believe it's, you know, knowing the enemy's doctrine is the key to winning the war.
I couldn't agree more. So give us your characterization of Sharia then, John.
Well, I would say I would actually begin characterizing it by saying I don't include my personal views. When my company teaches about Islam, we use the materials that are widely used in U.S. Islamic schools and organizations. So we've read a number of the texts in the United States. I've actually looked at school texts from Europe and Asia and Africa and elsewhere, and they are all the same as far as the core elements as they relate to the non-Muslim world. So when we, Understanding the Threat, teaches Sharia, we use the very books that they're using in not only in U.S., you know, we're based in Texas, for instance. So we have found these books in schools here in Texas and, as a matter of fact, on a military base and Goodfellow Air Force Base in San Angelo is one example. So it's not our perspective on it. We're teaching it what it is, and we're looking at the areas of Sharia that are consistent, unanimous with regard to the non-Muslim world, and that's what we teach. And when you look at that, it actually, again, makes everything that the U.S. has experienced since 9/11 and before make a lot of sense, and you can actually find a way forward to develop strategy. And our contention is you can't develop a winning strategy if you don't know this, because it's not going to be effective, which is why we're still fumbling around in the dark, even under this administration.
Now, I remember very well, John, working with you on a project we called Sharia, the Threat to America, a product of a distinguished group dubbed Team B2, because it was designed to, as was true of the storied Team B1, provide a kind of second opinion on the threat of our time in terms of Sharia and its adherence. And in that document, we talked about Sharia as a political, military, and legal doctrine, which to be sure has a patina of religiosity to it, but that is much more than that, a comprehensive way of life and so on. So when you're training people about Sharia and you're trying to help them understand the role that it plays in the lives of adherent Muslims, how do you characterize it, and how does that relate to the threatening quality of this doctrine?
That's a really good question, and I appreciate it for two reasons, but the biggest reason is because many people are hesitant to even discuss Islam because of the religious component, and they feel that religious liberty is important. Well, of course, they're right. It's paramount, especially in America, to understand that our unalienable rights are given to us by God, and therefore no government and no man can take them from us. And actually, the understanding of our founding principles are we can't even surrender unalienable rights if we wanted to, because they're inherent inside of us. And so many people are hesitant to discuss Islam because they feel it is merely a religion. And we simply are asking some questions. In the most widely used textbook for U.S. junior high schools, in Islamic high schools, junior highs, on the first substantive page, it says, and this is a direct verbatim quote, "Islam is not a religion, however, but a complete way of life." Now, that is how they define it. That's not how I characterize it. That's how they define it for their children. And what we find is when I look in books that I have from Africa, or we look at books that are used in Saudi Arabia or Pakistan or Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, or books that are used to teach Islam to Muslim children in other countries, they say the same thing, that Islam is a complete code or way of life governed by Sharia. And they literally say the Sharia comes from the Quran and the Sunnah, and Muslims' duty is to obey it the best they can. That's the whole purpose of Islam, and that is why we have to look at it, because whether we're talking about the 9/11 hijackers, whether we're talking about Ayatollah Khomeini and, you know, 79 in the Iranian Revolution, whether we're talking about the Boston Marathon bombers, or whether we're talking about any of the other jihadi attacks in the U.S. and Europe or elsewhere since 9/11, they all say they rely upon Sharia and seek to impose Sharia. And so simply all understanding the threat, and all I'm asking is, why aren't we teaching Sharia at our war colleges, at our military institutions, academies, and why is it that the understanding of our leaders about Islam and Sharia is exactly opposite of what Muslims are teaching their children in elementary and junior high schools in the United States? And that, to me, is the question that is yet to be answered.
Well, I know that you have an answer, though, born of a lot of hard experience, a graduate, as I mentioned, of one of those military academies, and a man who has done training inside the FBI before you left the Bureau. Why is it, John Guandolo, that we are not seeing Sharia as defined, as understood, as practiced by not all Muslims, I think it's important to say, but by adherent Muslims for sure, and I think by the authorities of the faith as well.
Well, I think the answer, the simple answer, or the first answer to that, is because the people that the United States is relying upon to tell us about this threat are not batting for our team. So these, when you rely on Muslim Brothers, for instance, to tell you about Islam, that's unprofessional.
Before we move on, though, John, just define that term. What do you mean by a Muslim brother? And what is their agenda? And why would you not want to be relying on them for guidance as to what we can say and, well, for that matter, think or even know about what they're up to?
Okay, professional analysis of a threat begins with identifying the threat objectively. So as I just mentioned a moment ago, whether it's the 9/11 hijackers, the Muslim in Chattanooga that killed four Marines and a Navy sailor, or it's the Boston Marathon bomber, the Fort Hood shooter, just this past week we've got so many incidents now, and now we know that the mechanic in Miami for the airlines is actually a jihadi, not a Christian. He lied about being a Christian, but there was a lot of evidence on the table to make that clear prior to it coming out just in the last couple of days. When you analyze a threat, you have to listen to what they say and begin your analysis there. When you get third-party advice from anybody about who the enemy is, that's unprofessional. The Muslim Brotherhood, the International Muslim Brotherhood, and of course they have the U.S. Muslim Brotherhood, their bylaws, their published bylaws, say that they are created to establish Sharia, Allah's law, in the land and fight to establish an Islamic state on the earth. And when you look at that objectively, you see that that's hostile. You see that organizations, through evidence already been entered in terrorism trials, reveals that certain organizations, many, if not all of the prominent Islamic organizations in the U.S., are a part of that hostile movement. And their leaders are advising secretaries of state, defense, national security staffs on what Islam actually is, instead of those U.S. professionals actually just opening up books of authoritative Islamic law and reading it for themselves, or reading a fourth grade textbook in a U.S. Islamic elementary school and seeing that what Al-Qaeda and ISIS say are the duties of Muslims actually are being taught to 10-year-olds.
You'd think that this sort of primary source information would be the guiding light, but instead we have been relying on people who have a tradition, let's be clear, of deceiving as well as advancing Sharia as our counsel. John, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting with one of my favorite people, John Guandolo. He is a warrior and has served his country in a number of capacities and continues to do so after his time in the Marine Corps and in the Federal Bureau of Investigations, and is these days the president and driving force behind Understanding the Threat, which does a remarkably important service, really, to all of us by helping explicate the nature of the enemy we're facing in the form of what I think of as Sharia-adherent Muslims. John Guandolo, you have in your book, Islam's Deception, The Truth About Sharia, of course, focused first and foremost on the extent to which those who engage in Sharia supremacism, at least inside countries like ours, sometimes go to considerable lengths to engage in deception to advance their agenda. You've talked a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood. I think most Americans have no idea of the fact that the Muslim Brotherhood is even here, let alone how expansive its footprint is and the degree to which it has succeeded in not only dominating the Muslim American community, I think much of which does not agree with its tenets or practices, but nonetheless, it has claimed and gotten away with being seen as the leaders of that community in many circles. And specifically, the deception has extended to the role of supplying information and guidance and lexicons and the like to the U.S. government. Can you just give us a sense of the magnitude of that part of the problem inside America today?
Yes, and that is another great question. And I think the beginning of the answer has to be, at least from my perspective, understanding that the deception is built on personal relationships that the Muslim Brotherhood and even others outside the Brotherhood that are working for the Islamic movement have really perfected. And it begins with a personal relationship, building it with somebody, whether it's a U.S. senator, a national security advisor, a four-star, three-star, two-star general. And then over time, once that relationship is built, trust is built, just like a intelligence, counterintelligence recruitment, then they begin encouraging policy changes, tactical changes, strategic changes. And since 9/11, as the former head of the Pentagon's Combating Terrorism and Technical Support Office said on a national radio program a couple of years ago, the Muslim Brotherhood controls the national security decision-making process for the U.S. government as it relates to Islam and these issues of terrorism, et cetera, whatever we call it today. That's how they do it. So whether it's a local police chief, a mayor, city council members, chamber of commerce, it begins with a personal relationship. Once they build the personal relationship, they influence the person on what the real problem is, and that, hey, Islam's got nothing to do with this. There are 1,000 interpretations, and you just let me help you find your way.
If I could just take a moment to pause on this point about those personal relationships. I remember that you've pointed out in the past that the tradecraft of the Muslim Brotherhood is that they're always the nicest guy in the room. And so when people, as is often the case, insist that this particular individual, a Muslim, is a very nice guy, and you know they've even befriended them, it often, you know, calls to mind that admonition. And I just wonder, to the extent that this is a aspect of the tradecraft and has greatly facilitated both the building of these personal relationships as well as the exploitation of those relationships. I'm stunned, frankly, by that comment by that counterterrorism guy, because as he's saying it, we are continuing, as best I can tell, to rely heavily on these nice guys to tell us you know, how to manage the Muslim American community and more generally the jihadi threat. No?
Yes, and let me just, I want to, two pieces here. They're not only the nicest guy in the room, they're normally the rightest guy in the room as it relates to their understanding of Sharia, and therein lies the problem. You are correct. You know, in my government experience, and even in my Marine Corps experience, but primarily in and out of the government, in the FBI, you know, people who are Muslim, who identify as Muslim, who don't want to live under Sharia and don't believe in Sharia, but that doesn't change what Sharia is and its role in Islam, that the whole purpose of Islam is to establish Sharia on the earth. That's the first part. So they're not only the nicest guy in the room, when it comes to understanding the requirements of Sharia and Islam, they're right. And so when understanding the threat says ISIS and Al-Qaeda have never been wrong about when they quote Islamic law and furtherance of their actions. That's the problem. However, individuals who don't want to adhere to Sharia, Muslims who don't want to adhere to Sharia, they don't constitute a different version of Islam. And the primary message in the inside the government today, the primary understanding is there are thousands of interpretations of Islam, so we have to get good Muslims, whatever that means, to help us with bad Muslims, whatever that means. And that is why we lost the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq, why Syria is a train wreck, and why we think Saudi Arabia is an ally right now.
And not least, why the Muslim Brotherhood is thriving inside our own country and running candidates for office and guiding American national security policy and the like. John, let me bring this to a very personal level. This Muslim Brotherhood apparatus and its alliance with, unlikely as it seems, it should be, but nonetheless, its alliance with people on the hard left is playing out in a court here in Dallas at the moment, where you are being sued by a former sheriff from Minnesota. Give us very quickly what's going on there and what's at stake.
Thank you for asking. Well, first of all, this reiterates the whole thing about building relationships. The former sheriff of Hennepin County, Minneapolis area, prior to the 2016 election, I wrote an article and we spent a week in Minnesota, not just in Minneapolis, all over the state. My team did. And we went all over and we spoke at many places. We met with leaders. We talked to many people. We had already been there, had a lot of information. Well, come July 2017, I was speaking with Chris Gobetz, at the time the vice president of Understand the Threat, at the National Sheriff's Conference. And that sheriff, Sheriff Rich Stanek of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, was very upset that I mentioned him in the article as being, you know, somebody who was working with jihadis, and the threat had gotten exponentially worse under his watch, both of which are true. And so he asked for a meeting, and when I refused to retract the article, it got very contentious and he assaulted me. And then he tried to charge me with assault. And anyway, where it ends up now is we're in criminal case. But here's the piece that I want everyone to hear. He said in open court that this wasn't about, he didn't bring this into the court to talk about assault, even though that's what's on the table legally. He said he did it to silence me and shut down UTT. The assault on us in the court has been unprecedented. I think his attorneys have been incredibly unprofessional, but it just so happens the two lead attorneys, Peter Krauss, a major fundraiser for Mr. Obama and held events with Mr. Obama in Dallas, Lisa Blue, who is Mrs. Clinton's largest fundraiser in the country, and who's in the courtroom all day, every day, but a board member from the Hamas doing business as the Council on American Islamic Relations, laughing and joking with the attorneys putting their arms around her, and the sheriff hanging out with her and chatting with her, even though he claimed on the stand he didn't even know who CARE was. They're just some advocacy group. So this is a real, discernible, and tangible effort to silence the truth about these threats because they know how effective we are. And they basically said it in court. And in his closing, the attorney basically called on the jury to shut down this hate and everything that we stand for because we're responsible for things like the Walmart shooting and Ferguson and all this other stuff. And he had visuals up there on the screen showing it. That is the assault in a court, which has nothing to do with the simple civil assault issue.
John Guandolo, you are a hero, as far as I'm concerned, for, again, both your cumulative service to our country and for your truth-telling. And I'm so appreciative of you coming on the show to talk a bit about your new book, Islam's Deception, The Truth About Sharia. And I hope you'll come back and talk to us. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.